Welcome to the Space Beyond Scarce podcast. I'm your host, life and business coach, Kate Hawley. I work with entrepreneurs and creative change makers who value depth, impact, and purpose. Many of my clients are like me. They dream of creating prosperity through the value they provide, but they also want equity for others and sustainability for our planet. The scarcity mindset of our culture tells us that this dream isn't possible, that we are not enough, that we don't have enough, that there is not enough for everyone, and that's just the nature of reality. But really, it's just the nature of predatory capitalism. I'm glad you're here because we are going to prove that sad story false and make better meaning to build our future with. Here we go. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Space Beyond Scarce podcast. I am your host, life and business coach, Kate Hawley. Today is my 43rd birthday, and it is the 43rd episode of this podcast. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for those of you who have offered positive feedback, reviews, kind words. It really helps me to find purpose in this when I know that it's helping you. Even the process of producing this podcast has been a real lesson for me in overcoming scarcity thinking. It's one of those things I've learned over and over again in various creative processes and other manifesting processes. A consistent lesson is that you just have to do what you can with what you have. And when you do that, you often find there is more resource there than you might have known. And that doesn't mean that you have everything you want. There's so many things that I hope to do still with this podcast. I hope to get a little bit more production support at some point. I hope to write a new theme song at some point soon. I hope to up-level in all kinds of ways. But for now, for this past year and a little bit that I've been producing it, it's been a really valuable process to just let it be good enough. It isn't perfect. It isn't everything I could dream of it being, but it's good enough, right? It's been valuable for me to remember that and to just get it out into the world, even though there's a part of me that really wants to perfectionate on it for weeks and months and years before I even let you have one single episode. So anyway, thank you and welcome to this 43rd episode on my 43rd birthday. Today, I want to talk a little bit about attachment theory. So this is something that has been coming up. I've been recently conducting a whole bunch of awesome interviews that are going to be on future podcast episodes in the coming months. They've all been really thought-provoking, and I can't wait to share them with you. And in at least a couple of these conversations, the concept of attachment has come up. And I've been like, I guess maybe I should take an episode to just explain what that even means for those of you that maybe don't use that language or haven't heard of that. And weirdly, it seems like it's been kind of trendy lately, or it's been showing up in more mainstream places than I'm used to seeing. I think it was on NPR's Life Kit podcast recently. They were talking about attachment theory. And then just, I think last week, I saw Glennon Doyle's podcast, We Can Do Hard Things, did a whole episode on attachment theory. So I thought it would be worth getting into. And it has a lot to do with scarcity mindset. So that's why we're going to go there. And in addition to talking a little bit about just what is attachment theory and why does that impact our potentially our relationships and our scarcity thinking, we're also going to talk about how we also have relationships to our resources. And so we're going to look at some of the different attachment styles as they would relate to a few different resources, just to give you an example of how this might work. I want to make a note as I'm going into this content that it comes from a dense body of research and kind of a lineage of multiple different psychologists over many decades. I am by no means an expert, and what I'm going to be doing today is absolutely going to be a simplification, and it's going to be based in my understanding of attachment theory. I do have a little bit of training in it. from the yoga therapy training program that I did. It was a 2-year program, and one of my teachers had a master's in clinical mental health counseling, and the other teacher, her husband, was a PhD level psychologist. And so they found it really important to teach us about various psychological theories. And essentially, we were learning it in the context of how would you apply Eastern philosophy and yogic support around the different attachment styles. And so even though I have a little bit of training, I'm just giving you that caveat that I'm sure there's a lot more to know about this. And I will share some resources in the links in the show notes. And I also want to say, I just couldn't help myself. I had to look up, what are all the criticisms of attachment theory? And it was really interesting to see there are some leading contemporary psychologists who are kind of debunking it or saying, we don't even think this is relevant. We don't think this is important. We don't even think this is based in the right research, which I just want to say, I'm going to tell you the story of how I learned about this. The first thing I thought when I learned about it is they were not asking the right questions. Because here's how it was framed to me. So let me set the stage a little bit. I started this yoga therapy training back in 2014. And the same week that this program, which was like a 2-year long program, the same week that it started, I found out that I was pregnant with my second son. And because of this, there was a lot of parallel development for me. I went through pregnancy, I went through childbirth, I went through having a newborn and a 3-year-old at the same time, all while I was still in this program. There was a lot of parallel kind of learning going on because, you know, parenthood is a huge learning curve. It's a huge body of work in a way. And even though I'd already been in it for a while with my first son, having 2 kids, it just was like a whole new level, right? And I was also really deepening my understanding of so many things through this program. So doing them at the same time, and especially because the program had so much information about how we develop psychologically, I, of course, was thinking about how does all of this stuff I'm learning apply to my children or to how I want to relate to my children, how I want to teach them and raise them. And at the same time as I was going through all of that, I'd also gone through this kind of awakening around the politics of motherhood. And so I was really aware of how under-resourced mothers, especially in America, are. And that's true for families in general, because we're so isolated, we've become so privatized that there's a lot of pressure on these tiny little family units to do so much caregiving and just come up with so much resource and to pay out of pocket for every hour of childcare and every hour of support. And because mothers are still doing way more of the domestic care and just household labor in this country, even though they more than ever are also in the workforce. Basically, we just have this kind of crisis of modern motherhood where mothers are doing so much and they're holding so much and they have so many responsibilities. So given that I'm really cognizant of how taxed mothers are, and yes, all caregivers, but I'm just saying mothers because I think they're under particular pressure and they're under particular scrutiny. And there's so much cultural misogyny directed at mothers to be responsible for everything and to feel guilty for everything and to feel like if anything goes wrong with your kid, it's completely 100% your fault. So when I learned about attachment theory and it was framed to me as basically being about how does maternal availability impact the psychological, emotional health of a developing child, it already felt really loaded. It felt like almost an offensive question. Because it was like, hey, mothers have been trying so damn hard for so damn long, and they've been giving so much unpaid labor that has been completely unappreciated. And now there's this study that's like, and by the way, maybe they're also responsible for completely messing their children up. So it's not that it wasn't, obviously, there was good reasons for the question. Obviously, it's true. It's important to have available caregivers when you're very young. It does make a difference. But I found myself immediately kind of pushing back on the question and saying, you know, even the day that we learned it in class, I raised my hand. I'm that student. I'm a total pain in the butt if you ever have me in class. I was like, well, have they ever studied paternal availability and the impact that that has on the developing infant? And have they ever studied the resources available to mothers and the support available to mothers in the society and how that impacts the attachment style of the infant? And as I asked these questions, he was like, oh, well, I'm not sure. I think so. But he didn't really have the answer on the ready. So I left kind of feeling like, all right, well, I'm going to look into this because there's got to be more to it. And I'll tell you, it was one of those moments. I've had a handful of these in my life where I felt a little bit red in the cheeks because I had been that person, that girl who is kind of being a challenger. And I was like, oh, am I doing it again? Am I like, you know, being unnecessarily challenging in class? But after the class, this woman came up to me. She actually had tears in her eyes. And she was like, I'm so glad that you said that because learning about this has made me feel so guilty. And she told me how her son, who is now in his 20s, is a heroin user. And she just couldn't stop feeling like it must have been something that she did that caused this. And I just want to share that story because I think if you're ever feeling like maybe I should say something, maybe I should ask a deeper question, maybe I should be a little bit of a challenger or just hold space for like, but what about people in this situation? There's probably some other people in the room who really need to hear that. So I'm sharing all of this to say that in this little examination of what attachment styles are and what attachment theory is, I really don't want anybody to use it as a way of internalizing blame or shame about your own parenting styles, if you are a parent, or even externalizing blame or shame of like, oh, well, the reason I'm so messed up is definitely, you know, I mean, it could be because of your mother. It could be because of your caregivers. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a process with that. Obviously, there's some things you need to unpack about that. But the frame I want to put this in is that I think it can be useful in our personal journey of growth and healing and kind of reparenting ourselves, which I think we all have to do at some point. We all have to develop our attachment to ourselves. We all have to re-examine, how did I learn to relate to things? And is that working for me? And are there some updates that I want to make to how I'm relating in the world? You know, I just don't want attachment theory to be used as another weapon against women and mothers, because we don't need to perpetuate this hyper-individualized culture. And I also want to say that when I looked into this question a little bit, I did see that there's been some additional research on attachment theory in different cultures. And it is true that infants can form attachment to any caregiver who is sensitive and responsive to them, doesn't have to be their mother. It's also true that in cultures where infants are raised by more of a variety of family and community members, which is lots of human societies, by the way, probably a smart way to do it, where there's not as much of this individualized emphasis on the mother is the one and only emotional resource available to the infant. Studies have actually shown not only can those children who have multiple caregivers grow up with secure attachment, but they also have enhanced capacities to view the world from multiple perspectives. So it's possible that the challenge we have in this culture has nothing to do with the mother. It has to do with the false scarcity premise that we've even approached child rearing with, that says we need this woman to do it all. We need this mother to do everything. We need her to take 100% of the responsibility for all of it. Even if you have an awesome caregiver at home, you're probably still going to be lonely if that's the only person you ever see as a kid. You're probably still going to wonder, how do I form relationships to other types of people? So it makes a lot of sense to me that probably the most securely attached humans are the ones who are raised by multiple loving caregivers, like extended family members and community members. And I would love to see our culture shift in the way that we treat that, that to shift to say, we are all raising each other, but we are all helping each other learn how to attach. So, all right, now that I've had my little soapbox moment, I'm going to give you some of the basics. Oh, I want to add this one more thing. I'm going to get back on the soapbox for just a minute. So I also want to say that because essentially what attachment theory is about is how do we develop a secure attachment? How do we feel safe that we're going to get our needs met? And it's rooted in this idea that we develop that really early in life when we're babies, and that the response that we receive to our bids for attention and our communication and our basic needs, that, you know, if we get all of our needs met and if there's a lot of responsiveness by our caregivers, then we learn that we're taken care of and that my needs are going to get met if I ask for them to be met. And that means, you know, that I can have a little bit more freedom to explore and take risks and do other things and know that there's always going to be this secure base for me. But what I want to propose is that we actually have a culture at large that really, I think, perpetuates insecure attachment. So that even if you were raised from a very young age to feel that you were going to get your needs met, that's not necessarily going to feel true to you when you leave home, because economic inequity and lack of a social safety net is an actual, literal daily reminder that you could fall through the cracks, that there are people all around you who are not getting their needs met, that we allow that to happen. That is the society we live in. That is the culture we live in. So I don't know about you, but I don't know how it would be possible to feel totally secure in a society like that. Because even if your individual parents were responsive or your individual caregivers are responsive, the meta caregiver, the culture at large, and the way that we care for each other is so dysfunctional. It's so neglectful that it makes sense to me that we live in a culture just full of people who are having kind of insecure attachment challenges. So, all right, that was my last thing on the soapbox of systems and how they might impact this. We do need to think about that. But let me just step down for a second. I'll give you the rundown. The language I'm going to share is more from the research on how does attachment style show up in adults. The language is just a little bit different from some of the language they use for the infants. And I'm sharing this because my assumption is that everyone who is listening to this is probably an adult, or if you're actually paying attention, you're an adult who is interested in how does this now impact me. It's also worth noting that there are other factors, obviously, besides your attachment style, like your temperament and your external circumstances and other mental health issues you might have and trauma issues and neurodiversity. All different kinds of things can influence what's going to end up showing up in your attachment style. So let's just start with the basics of kind of the holy grail of attachment, which is the thing they call secure attachment. So secure attachment in the theory is something that develops from knowing from a very young age, from infancy, that your caregivers will be responsive to your needs and your communication and your bids for attention. And if you have this in early childhood, it can be really influential as to how you go on to attach in other relationships. It can definitely be fluid, like we've kind of mentioned, where maybe you grew up without secure attachment, but you can learn how to do it. You can learn how to experience it in other relationships as you grow up. It's also possible for someone who grew up in a securely attached environment to still end up in some type of dysfunctional relationship that might reprogram their sense of safety, right? So other things can impact it. So I'm going to read a little blurb. This is just from Wikipedia that talks about some of the traits of securely attached adults. So they've been linked to a high need for achievement and a low fear of failure. Within relationships, a securely attached adult will appear with the following traits: excellent conflict resolution, mentally flexible, effective communicators, avoidance of manipulation, comfortable with closeness without fearfulness of being enmeshed, quickly forgiving, viewing sex and emotional intimacy as one, believing they can positively impact their relationship, and caring for their partner in the way that they want to be cared for. Securely attached adults believe that there are many potential partners that would be responsive to their needs. And if they come across an individual who is not meeting their needs, they will typically lose interest. So I thought that part was really interesting because it speaks to already a kind of common scarcity mindset that some of us may have that says, oh, there's not going to be that many people who can meet my needs in the world. So I just have to kind of cling to what I have. And what they're proposing is that a securely attached individual would be more likely to say, you know, lots of people can meet my needs. So with that abundance of people who are capable of meeting my needs in the world, I'm not going to spend a lot of time staying in a relationship that doesn't meet my needs. Sounds nice, right? Okay, so we're going to circle back to this and we're going to look at it through the lens of a few different resources in just a minute. But before we get there, I want to highlight a couple of other attachment styles besides the secure type. So the next type is sometimes called anxious preoccupied. We're just going to go ahead and refer to it as anxious attachment style. The theory in terms of infant attachment is that this can develop from an inconsistent response from your caregivers, or kind of an abandonment or an experience of abandonment from your caregivers. In these circumstances, perhaps you developed an orientation or a belief that you may not get your needs met, or that even when someone is showing you love, you can't trust that they're going to stick around, or you can't trust that it will last, or you can't quite trust that that love is actually secure and stable. And what can often happen with that anxious attachment is a response that it can look a lot of different ways. It can look anxious. It can look like anger or passive aggressiveness. It can look like helplessness or kind of manipulative, controlling behaviors, you know, different types of bids for attention to try to keep people hooked. And so these anxious, preoccupied types might seek high levels of intimacy and approval and responsiveness from their partners to a degree that is potentially overly dependent. They may tend to be less trusting or have less positive views about themselves or their partners. They may exhibit high levels of emotional expressiveness and worry and impulsiveness in their relationships. They're more likely to overreact to the anticipation of separation or the actual separation from their attachment figure. And I'm, again, reading from Wikipedia. It goes on to say that adults with this attachment style often project their anxieties onto otherwise benign social interactions, regardless of if the interaction is face-to-face or through a text-based medium, such as instant messaging or email. Starting to feel familiar to some of us, their thoughts and actions can lead to a painful cycle of self-fulfilling prophecies, possibly leading to self-sabotage. So this is maybe the most classic of, if I was to say, what would it look like if you put scarcity mindset into how you relate to other people or how you attach to other people, this is exactly what it would look like. It's just the core story is, I'm not going to get enough love. They don't love me enough. I'm unlovable. I'm not good enough. This is not stable enough. There's just this constant sense of insecurity and fear that, as they're saying, creates this self-perpetuating cycle, because that's a really difficult relationship to be in for the other party. If they're saying, no, I love you, we're good, but it is never believed, right? There's never enough to satiate that kind of insatiable need to be loved more, because fundamentally that anxious attachment does not believe that that love can ever be what it needs to be. Okay, so then the other kind of primary style that we're going to be looking at is sometimes called dismissive avoidant attachment style. And this emerges also as a defense mechanism to, it could be inconsistent availability of caregivers or sense of abandonment, but it's sort of a different way of responding. So rather than responding from trying to kind of cling more and say, ooh, I feel you slipping away, so I'm going to like glom onto you even more, the dismissive avoidant is more of a like, you know what? It's not safe to need other people. Like, other people are just not a stable source. That's not a possible thing. So rather than ramping up their efforts to keep other people around, they're going to be more likely to convince themselves that they don't need anybody at all. So again, reading from Wikipedia here, they desire a high level of independence, often appearing to avoid attachment altogether. They view themselves as self-sufficient, invulnerable to attachment feelings, and not needing close relationships. They tend to suppress their feelings, dealing with conflict by distancing themselves from partners of whom they often have a poor opinion. They may lack the interest of forming close relationships and maintaining emotional closeness with the people around them. They may have a great amount of distrust in others, but at the same time possess a positive model of themselves. So they would prefer to invest in their own ego skills. And because of their distrust, they cannot be convinced that other people have the ability to deliver emotional support. They try to create high levels of self-esteem by investing disproportionately in their abilities or accomplishments. These adults maintain their positive views of self based on their personal achievements and competence, rather than searching for and feeling acceptance from others. They may explicitly reject or minimize the importance of emotional attachment. They strive for self-reliance and independence. When it comes to the opinions of others about themselves, they may be very indifferent, and are relatively hesitant to solicit positive feedback from their peers. And at the end of the day, it may sound really different from the anxious attachment style, but it's coming from a lot of the same places. It's just a different approach. There may be some of the same scarcity stories in the end of like, I'm not lovable enough, or there's not enough love for me, or there's not even anybody who's capable of really loving me securely. So what's the point? But because there's a more of a focus on independence and self-reliance, the scarcity stories they may be really struggling with may be more self-focused. Like, I'm not good enough. I haven't done enough. That sense of like, I need to achieve more because that's actually where my stability comes from. But there's still that sense of something is missing and I'm not safe until I get it. So they still are going to have something, a kind of fundamentally scarce or insecure approach to their lives. And the other aspect of that is, of course, that without other people, we really can't get all of our needs met because that's impossible. We need other people to meet our needs. And so the dismissive avoidant folks might be experiencing scarcity because of not being willing to get help from others or not acknowledging that that's actually a resource that they need. So there is one more type. I'm not going to go too far into this type, but it's the one that is sometimes called fearful avoidant. And I've heard it referred to as disorganized attachment, which is a little bit more of what could emerge from kind of a hot and cold consistency from caregivers, which if you are the child of a narcissist, that's really common, that they can be super warm and charming and loving in this, in one type of way, like in a certain mood. And then they can just flip and be really cold and abusive even. And that can be super confusing, especially for infants and young children, where they really crave that warmth and that love and that approval. And it's sort of being turned on and off like a faucet. So fearful avoidant folks can have mixed feelings about close relationships. They desire it, and they also feel uncomfortable with that closeness. They want to form social relationships, and they fear the relationships at the same time. And that can translate into mistrusting the relationships they do form and also viewing themselves as unworthy, sort of a mashup of the other two styles, the worst of both worlds, right? So for our purposes today, I'm going to focus on the previous three styles that I named. So what I wanted to look at, just to kind of explore, so much of attachment theory is based on our relationships with other people, and that's, of course, very important. But we also have relationships to our resources. And I wanted to give a few examples. These are all speculation, but they're my speculations on how might it look if we were to apply certain attachment styles to these different resources. So I'm going to work with three specific resources. We're going to do money, because that's a really common challenge for folks. We're going to do time, which is another really common challenged resource. And then we're going to look at worthiness, which is very similar, I think, to the initial attachment theory resource that they're really working with. But I think of worthiness as being kind of its own thing. It's not necessarily just about, do other people think I'm worthy? It's really about, do we believe in our own value and our own good enoughness, right? I'm going to go through each one of these resources and just briefly touch on how might it look if somebody had a different attachment style and was working with this resource. So we're going to start with money. And we're going to start with this question of what might it look like if we had an anxious attachment to money? So I think there might be a preoccupation and a fear of never having enough money that would drive certain behaviors. And I don't know that you'd be able to tell from the behaviors themselves, because they could be motivated by different things. But that could look like hoarding wealth, right? Like, there's never going to be enough, or this could all disappear one day, so I'm just going to stockpile it and hoard it, never spend it. It could look just like chasing after money in ways that are self-compromising. A lot of us do. And some of us do that out of necessity, but that could look like overworking or over-delivering, right? Like giving more than you really need to, because you want to make sure that that opportunity will stick around. That can look like workaholism, or I think of, you know, taking on every single way to make money that you possibly can, even if it doesn't pay you very much, or even if it's not what you even want to be doing, because you're scared that you'll never get another opportunity to make money, or you'll never get enough. So you just kind of take everything on. I think it can look like feeling fearful about both spending money and making money. You may also, from an anxious attachment, find that you overspend because spending money comforts that anxious part of you. It might bring you like a little jolt of intimacy and connection with the thing that's missing. But ultimately, if we use money as a way to soothe our anxiety, we could ultimately end up in financial trouble, right? Like debt. Or if you have anxious attachment, but you have a lot of money, it may also become something that you're using in ways to create dependency or a sense of obligation with other people, maybe giving it to other people, but then expecting them to behave a certain way in return. Or because there's also the possibility that the anxious attachment will turn into helplessness, because it's another way of getting people to stick around is like, I'm helpless without you, so you have to stick around. So there might even be a sense of helplessness around money and dependency on other people who kind of intervene to save you. So again, those are just some speculations on how that might look. Now, if you were relating to money from a dismissive, avoidant attachment style, there might be a tendency to want to avoid the whole issue. Like, I don't care about money. I don't need money, right? That could look like avoiding looking at your bank statements and not tracking your income, not tracking your expenses. However, it could also look, again, like workaholism, because dismissive avoidant attachment is prone to really wanting self-sufficiency and independence and personal accomplishment and achievement. So they could be workaholics, but that could be coming from a different scarcity story than the anxiously attached person. So again, that need for self-sufficiency that will make sure that you never need help from anyone else financially. So even though on the surface, it may look fine, it may look like someone is being perfectly healthy with money. It's good to be self-sufficient with money, right? But what is driving that? What is the story underneath it? And is money being used as a substitute for relational security with other people? Okay, so what would a secure attachment to money potentially look like? And by the way, if you're going to take away one kind of journal prompt, take away that question about whatever resource you're working with. What might a secure attachment to this resource look like for me? So I think a secure attachment to money might look like you believe that you're going to be taken care of. You believe that there's many different ways to get your financial needs met and that you don't need to compromise yourself or your values to do it. It might look like nurturing your relationship to money by paying attention to it, tracking your income and expenses from a place of care, making decisions about how to earn and how to spend that align with your values. So being really intentional about that. There might be more of an easy time trusting that money is going to be reciprocal. So you can be generous in spending and supporting other people. And also you can ask for it to come back to you. You can be open and willing to ask for help with money when you need it. You can feel confident in your value and price your services or negotiate your salary so that it fits what you need. It might look like a willingness to save and invest, to honor the future self, while also valuing spending money on experiences that deepen relationships with other people. So ultimately, I think a secure attachment with money might not treat money and work and spending as a way to replace love and connection or to prove worthiness. I'm just going to say that one more time. A secure attachment to money might look like not treating money and work and spending as a way to replace love and connection or prove worthiness. Ultimately, I think secure attachment to money means that we feel like we have a sense of agency to use money as a tool to meet our needs. And that's what it is. And that's all it is. It's a tool to meet our needs. Okay, so we're going to look at time. So an anxious attachment to time might look like wanting to control and schedule how every minute is spent. So there might be a lot of stress about being on time. There's likely a feeling at the end of each day that you didn't do enough with your time, that time was too scarce. There might be some difficulty slowing down, some impatience, an underlying story of there is not enough time for me to be safe. There may also be some FOMO here, like some fear of missing out, that desire to do everything so that you won't be left out of anything. And there may also be kind of a victim mindset around time or a sense of helplessness to have any influence over it. Like, well, I wanted to do that, but I never had enough time. I just can't get enough time, right? And again, this is not to say that there aren't legitimate time scarcity challenges that we're also naming, but that if that's a chronic condition that like I never have enough time for what I wanted to do or said I was going to do because I'm so helpless, right? Then there might be something to look at there. So a dismissive or avoidant attachment to time could look the same, but I'm going to say that it might also look like avoiding dealing with time, which might look like you never plan, maybe procrastination, really feeling like I don't want to be controlled or influenced by time. So maybe you show up late because you're not paying attention to time. Again, because we've also established that that dismissive avoidant attachment style can lead to compulsive levels of self-sufficiency and the need to grow self-esteem through accomplishments and achievements, it may also end up looking like overworking, overscheduling, not paying attention to the actual needs and limitations of time, using productivity or that kind of hyper competence of like, look how much I can do with my time to prove that you don't need anyone's help, or maybe to avoid the loneliness of having distanced yourself in your relationships. So what might a secure attachment to time look like? It might look like prioritizing your time based on your deepest values and your biggest dreams, investing plenty of time in self-care, in your health, and in your relationships with others, having the mental flexibility to speed up when you need to accomplish something that's important to you, and to slow down when you need to relax or enjoy your life. I think it would come from the belief that you will have enough of what you need regardless of how you spend your time, so you don't put that pressure on time to be the source of your sense of safety or worthiness. A sense of agency might come with this, that you can organize your time to meet your needs. Okay, so the last resource we're going to look at here, and feel free to do this practice with other resources that you might want to improve your relationship with. We're going to look at worthiness. So an anxious attachment style, I think, might approach this with the essence of what Brené Brown refers to as hustling for worthiness. So in that approach, it's not a given that you're worthy. You have to earn it, right? You have to prove it at every step. There's never a sense of being good enough to know that you're safe, that people will love you and stay with you, that you're going to get your needs met. So what motivates the desire to quote unquote get better is actually a scarcity-driven mindset. I'm not good enough. I must get better to be safe. But the problem with this is that there's no measurement of good enough that will ever feel meaningful when you're in this mindset. That never good enough feeling might drive these folks to need constant affirmation and validation that they are good enough. But even if they receive it, they're not likely to believe it, or it might just be like a quick hit of a drug that just doesn't last. So then that need for affirmation and validation is just going to come right back the next moment. A dismissive or avoidant attachment to worthiness might disengage from that hustle for worthiness, maybe saying, I don't care what other people think of me. I don't need to be that good at things. It might actually look like having very little ambition or very little drive, because if you don't try to be good at anything, then you can't fail or be rejected at it. So that's one way of not needing anyone's approval, right? So you might notice that version. But again, another way it can show up is through high achieving behaviors that may from the outside appear like self-confidence. But again, it's really about what is motivating it. If it's motivated by a compulsive need to prove self-sufficiency, then it could be coming from that avoidant place. Because again, the avoidant attachment might think, if I just achieve at a high enough level, I'll be safe from that vulnerability of needing anyone else's approval or support. I'll be able to get out of this. I'll be able to get out of the messiness of what other people might think of whether I was good enough or not. So a secure attachment to worthiness, I think, would start from a genuine belief that you are worthy as you are. Nothing is missing. From that place, you're safe to play with what is possible, right? To take risks in order to achieve your dreams, or to follow your callings, or to explore the potential of something. So from that place, you might be more open to trying new things, even if you're not good at them yet, because you won't be as worried that failure means you're not good enough. You know that's not what it means, because you know you're already good enough. You'll be motivated by a deeper purpose than to prove your worthiness, which ultimately will allow you to show up in service to others in a deeper way. So I want to just make sure I was clear that even though you may have a tendency to attach in a certain way, this is not a typing system. You're not permanently hedged into a certain identity as like, I'm always going to be avoidant dismissive, right? You probably exhibit more than one of these attachment styles, depending on the context and the relationship. And you can learn from the place in your life where you're the most securely attached. You can use that to learn how you want to be in other relationships in your life. I mostly wanted to share this because I know that if scarcity mindset is a struggle, that there's likely an insecure attachment in one or more areas that is driving it. And I hope that you can have a lot of compassion for yourself if that's you, and a lot of compassion for the people around you if that's them. And the one thing that is helpful about placing this way back in our infancy is that it helps us remember it's really not our fault. Like, we did not choose to feel insecure about whether we're going to be safe. That's not something anybody would choose. But it is possible to start to shift how we relate to it and how we feel about it. So if you tend towards anxious attachment, then my takeaway for you would be to work on cultivating that trust that there will be enough for you no matter what, that you can slow down that hustle for worthiness and remember that you are enough as you are. You can start shifting out of a sense of being a victim to people that will always abandon you, and step into noticing that you're also a creator and that you have agency in your life. If you tend towards that more dismissive avoidant, you might find it helpful to work on cultivating an openness to reciprocity, to giving and receiving, to surrendering control and inviting and allowing resources to flow to you and through you. And it might be healing to remember that other people want to be invited to help you. It's safe to receive support from others. So there's some work there on tolerating vulnerability and intimacy and open-heartedness. And the work is going to need to happen probably in baby steps with the people and in the situations that you already have the most trust for. Ultimately, we can all deepen our inner secure base through taking as much care as possible of our physical and mental health, and investing in the practices that regulate our nervous system and really help us feel safe from the inside out. This is part of why this showed up when I was in yoga therapy training, again, because that's a practice and an approach. It's not the only one. There are so many. That's really about learning, not from a theoretical, like, okay, yeah, that's a nice idea. I'm enough as I am, right? But no, like, this breath that you just took just kept you alive. It literally just kept you alive. Like, you literally are carrying that sufficiency in you and with you every moment. And when you turn towards the resources you have and you appreciate them and you use them for self-regulation, it can be a really powerful process of healing and, again, forming secure attachment to the self. Thank you again so much for being with me through episode 43 on my 43rd birthday. I'm not going to officially end season one. I don't know, maybe ever or not anytime soon. I have a bunch more episodes to give you. So this is kind of my little marker of, like, I just want to take a minute to celebrate how far we've come and say that I'm really looking forward to continuing to learn and research and share what I find with you, and bring on amazing, interesting guests who can also shine light on this. If you have any special requests of things that you want us to cover on this podcast, or questions or comments, please feel free to reach out to me anytime, kate@katehawley.com, or you can find everything in the show notes and on my website, which is also katehawley.com. Don't forget to sign up for my Monday newsletter, where I will be sharing some practices and prompts that accompany today's episode. That's it for today. I'm wishing you a week of fully knowing, believing, and trusting that you are enough just as you are. Thanks for listening to today's episode of The Space Beyond Scarce. If you enjoyed this episode, please go over to Apple iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and review. It really helps out a new podcaster. Thank you.